go with a larger number of troops. Rumsfeld is a great bureaucratic infighter, recalled the planner. He's also not as doctrinal as people think. In this officer's account, Rumsfeld put on the table General Downing's plan for invading Iraq with just 10,000 troops as a bargaining move, done in the knowledge that the existing Central Command invasion plan, written under General Zinni, called for an invasion force of at least 300,000. What's more, Rumsfeld almost certainly knew that the invasion force ultimately chosen would be closer in size to Zinni's than to Downing's. But he was going to make the military fight for every incremental increase in the size of the force. A lot of folks say the military rolled over for Rumsfeld, this officer concluded. We didn't. We did the best we could. In June 2002, Renouard, sitting in the hot seat of operations director at Central Command, began to believe that the war plan he was working on for Iraq was going to be executed. But his discussions were extremely close-hold, he recalled, really involving just Rumsfeld and Franks, with Bush and Cheney briefed on occasion. Franks was told to keep a very tight control on decision-making, with it just a matter of Rumsfeld to Franks and a lot of decisions pushed up to Franks, that usually would have been handled by lower-ranking officials, but who in this case were not included in the planning. One unfortunate side effect of this narrowing seems to have been to limit consideration both of dissenting views and of longer-term issues, two problems that Franks already had experienced in his handling of the war in Afghanistan, which, insiders said, had been extremely messy. Those who could read the Bush administration best saw that war was coming, even before there had been much public debate. Two very different meetings bring this home, one among top British officials in London, the other among Marine commanders near San Diego. In midsummer, Sir Richard Dearlove, the head of MI6, the British intelligence agency, came to Washington for meetings at the CIA and with other officials. When he returned to London, he met with the top officials in the British National Security Establishment. There was a perceptible shift in attitude in the Bush administration, he told his colleagues on July 23rd, according to a memo summarizing the talk that subsequently was leaked. Military action was now seen as inevitable. Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD. But the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. There was little discussion in Washington of the aftermath after military action. But much of the top brass wasn't persuaded of the wisdom of invading Iraq. Especially in the Army, there were profound doubts both about invading Iraq and about adopting a policy of preemption. Even one of the few military men Rumsfeld listened to, a retired four-star general, said at the time that containment was the way to go. He argued that what the U.S. government wanted was a secular, unified Iraq led by someone kinder and gentler than Saddam, and that was what it was getting closer to every day as Saddam aged and weakened. That summer, many generals had three major concerns about invading Iraq: the possibility of Saddam's using weapons of mass destruction, the danger of becoming enmeshed in urban warfare, and the worry that a post-war occupation could be costly, especially if the United States had to put in thousands of troops to hold the country together. I can't tell you how many senior officers said to me, "What in the hell are we doing?" recalled Marine Lieutenant General Gregory Newbold, who had been the J3, or Director of Operations, on the Joint Staff since October 2000. Yet for all those doubts, only one top officer really deeply objected to the entire war plan. That was Newbold, who, as the Joint Staff's Director of Operations, was aware of almost everything of significance going on in the U.S. military and to the classified information it was receiving. Many other senior officers weren't as opposed as Newbold, but still were worried about the particulars of the plan. Despite Franks's determined efforts to keep them from reviewing it, some began to get glimpses. One officer spent a summer weekend studying Annex Bravo, the intelligence section of the war plan. He came away deeply puzzled by a major discrepancy in its treatment of weapons of mass destruction. "The target list didn't match the text," he said. The text was full of "we're not sure, we don't know this," but then when he turned to the target list, it offered, as if certain of its information, about 100 confirmed or positive weapons of mass destruction sites. Nor did the plan assess the impact on the region. It was completely stovepiped on Iraq. Nothing about terrorism or the impact on Saudi Arabia. This was just incomplete work, in his view. He sent his comments along, but never received a response. When Rumsfeld was asked about the worries being expressed inside the military, and specifically about a Washington Post article that summarized those concerns, using mainly unnamed sources, his response was both disingenuous and dismissive. "You know, the Pentagon's a big place. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of military personnel. Hundreds of thousands of civilian personnel," he said at a press conference at the headquarters of the Joint Forces Command in Suffolk, Virginia. "Any reporter who wants to can go find one or more that'll have a position on any issue, all the way across the spectrum. Then what they do is, they write stories that seem to fit what they feel might make a good story, and they go around and ask questions until they find people that say those things, and then they print. Now, I don't know," he continued. "They don't say who those people are, so I can't go and say, 'Gee, have you got a better idea?' Can't seem to do that. Who they are, no one knows. It's a big mystery, and life's like that." The officers who were talking to the Post and other news outlets, Rumsfeld concluded, were ill-informed. The defense secretary said he talked to senior military officers all the time and didn't hear such concerns. Thus, in Rumsfeld's formulation, military dissent about Iraq had to be considered the result of ignorance. To some at Central Command's headquarters in Tampa, the view was less mysterious. Hooker, the command's lead intelligence analyst for Iraq, later would blame Rumsfeld squarely for undermining the formulation of the war plan. "From the outset," he said, "the disagreements between Rumsfeld's office and the military about whether to invade Iraq, and if so, how many troops to use, were rooted in conflicting assessments of the threat Iraq presented and the difficulties that would result from invading and occupying the country. But instead of examining and reconciling the differences," Hooker wrote, "Rumsfeld and Franks let them fester for months as Rumsfeld pushed for a smaller invasion force. There was no authoritative, systematic review and consolidation of viewpoints between intelligence producers and senior policymakers," Hooker concluded, in a post-war analysis of intelligence problems in the war plan. "Rather than determine which point of view was correct, the planners simply split the difference," he wrote. Chapter 4, The War of Words, August 2002. In August 2002, the tone of the Bush administration's rhetoric changed sharply. That was the month, said Greg Thielman, then director of proliferation issues in the State Department's Intelligence Bureau, when the administration started speaking about Iraq in much shriller tones. It no longer was just a concern that needed watching. It became an imminent security threat that has to be dealt with right away. It also was the time when the administration's public statements about Iraq's weapons grew more distant from the intelligence on which they were supposedly based, said Thielman, who a month later retired from his job at the State Department, not in protest, but privately disturbed by what he later called the administration's sustained campaign of misrepresenting the intelligence on Iraq. The debate on invading Iraq effectively began with 2 days of hearings held by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on July 31st and August 1st. These discussions, with 18 experts on national security and the Middle East, spurred widespread discussion, most notably by sending Brent Scowcroft into public opposition to Bush administration policy on Iraq. So-called Republican realists, no fans of the neoconservatives, were alarmed by the shift they saw in the administration's posture. This group, which included many veterans of the first Bush administration, saw Colin Powell as its primary ally inside the government. Scowcroft, national security advisor to the first President Bush, staked out the realist position on CBS's Face the Nation, where he warned that a U.S. invasion of Iraq could turn the whole region into a cauldron and thus destroy the war on terrorism. A few days later, he made a more comprehensive argument on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, a significant location because the journal's conservative editorial page sometimes acts like an internal bulletin board for Republican policymaking. Scowcroft's article appeared in the newspaper's edition of August 15, 2002, under the headline, "Don't Attack Saddam." "We will all be better off when he is gone," the retired general and Bush family confidant began. But he wanted to know what the case was for doing so at the moment. There was scant evidence to tie Saddam to terrorist organizations, and even less to the September 11 attacks. What's more, there is little evidence to indicate that the United States itself is an object of his aggression. So, Scowcroft methodically proceeded, attacking Iraq would undercut the U.S. counteroffensive against terrorism. Some of his secondary points were prescient, such as his prediction that a military campaign very likely would have to be followed by a large-scale, long-term military occupation. Others were less so, such as his concern that a cornered Saddam would hit Israel with weapons of mass destruction, possibly provoking a nuclear response. Scowcroft was most worried by the regional effects. His bottom line? If we reject a comprehensive perspective, however, we put at risk our campaign against terrorism as well as stability and security in a vital region of the world. In the following days, Republican mandarins Henry Kissinger and James Baker issued their own warnings to President Bush. A spate of cautionary articles echoing Scowcroft's concerns also appeared in the following weeks in publications aimed at military professionals. Like nighttime clouds illuminated by flashes of distant artillery fire, the public discussion reflected dimly the fight inside the Bush administration. Powell, who was not only the Secretary of State, but a retired four-star general who maintained ties to the top brass, launched a final effort to stop the run-up to war. Bob Woodward relates in his book Plan of Attack how Powell sat down with Bush on the evening of August 5th, first over dinner and then in the president's office in his residence. "You are going to be the proud owner of 25 million people," Powell said, according to Woodward. "You will own all their hopes, aspirations, and problems. It's going to suck the oxygen out of everything. This will become the first term." But Condi Rice, who knew Bush better, read the situation differently. Rather than trying to stop the move toward war, she was constructing the bureaucratic machinery to coordinate the execution of the war. On August 14th, according to Woodward, she chaired a principals meeting on a draft of a strategy for Iraq. She also took a major bureaucratic step toward war, taking control of an interagency group then being run by the staff of the Joint Chiefs at the Pentagon, and putting one of her own NSC subordinates, Franklin Miller, in charge. Renamed the Executive Steering Group, and including representatives from the State Department, the CIA, the White House, the Joint Chiefs, and the Pentagon's policy operation, this body was charged with coordinating about 100 government actions leading up to the invasion, such as securing the use of bases in the region, improving them so they could support U.S. military operations, and getting overflight permission from other countries. Vice President Cheney emphatically shut down the nascent debate on August 26th when he asserted, "There is no doubt that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction, or WMD." In a speech to the National Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars at the Opryland Hotel in Nashville, Cheney flatly called for war, proclaiming that Iraq was a clear and present danger to the United States. After a few preliminary niceties, the vice president struck his theme. "The president and I never for a moment forget our number one responsibility, to protect the American people against further attack and to win the war that began last September 11th. Despite various measures like creating a Department of Homeland Security," he said, "we realize that wars are never won on the defensive. We must take the battle to the enemy." In retrospect, the speech is even more stunning than it appeared to be then, because it has become clear with the passage of time that it constructed a case that was largely false. "Containment may have worked in the Cold War," Cheney said, "but is not possible when dictators obtain weapons of mass destruction and are prepared to share them with terrorists who intend to inflict catastrophic casualties on the United States. It was time to be candid," he said. "The Iraqi regime has, in fact, been very busy enhancing its capabilities in the field of chemical and biological agents, and they continue to pursue the nuclear program they began so many years ago. Many of us are convinced that Saddam Hussein will acquire nuclear weapons fairly soon. Nothing the U.S. government had tried in the previous decade had stopped Saddam, Cheney warned. Not inspections, not the revelations of defectors, not Desert Fox. Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction, he said, as flatly as possible. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us. Not only that, but the situation was getting worse. Time is not on our side, Cheney added. The risks of inaction are far greater than the risks of action. Anthony Zinni, recently retired from the Marine Corps, sat behind Cheney on the stage that day as the speech was delivered. As he listened to the vice president, he nearly fell off his chair. In my time at CENTCOM, I watched the intelligence and never, not once, did it say he has WMD. Since retiring, he had retained all his top-secret clearances. He was still consulting with the CIA on Iraq. He had reviewed all the current intelligence, and he had seen nothing to support Cheney's certitude. It was never there. Never there, he said later. These guys are going to war without the evidence to back them up, he thought to himself that day. His second chilling thought, he recalled, was that they didn't understand what they were getting into. For his part, he couldn't figure out the change in Cheney. In Zinni's experience, the vice president was a realist, a hard-headed man who demanded the hard facts. From their encounters in Arab capitals in the 1990s, he had said he had come to think of Cheney as very practical. But that wasn't what he was seeing that August day in Nashville. When he sort of got tied up and embraced all this, it seemed to be out of character. It really confused me. What he didn't know then was that Cheney had changed. Perhaps because he knew the Bush administration hadn't performed well in heeding warnings before 9/11. Or perhaps because of his heart ailments, which can alter a person's personality. In early October, Zinni went public with his doubts. I'm not convinced we need to do this now, he told a meeting of the Middle East Institute. Of Saddam, he said, I believe he is containable at this moment. There were other priorities in U.S. foreign policy. My personal view is, I think this isn't number one. It's maybe sixth or seventh. But Zinni's cause was already lost. Inside the Bush administration, Cheney's speech hit like a preemptive strike. Bush himself had been at his ranch in Crawford, Texas, when it was delivered. My understanding was that the president himself was very surprised at that speech, because it was kind of constraining his options, said a former senior Bush administration official. It had the effect of somewhat limiting the president's options, in my view. Cheney's speech had a powerful effect elsewhere in the government. His hard-line, no-debate stance was adopted by others in the administration. We know they have weapons of mass destruction, Rumsfeld would assert a month later at a Pentagon briefing. We know they have active programs. There isn't any debate about it. In September 2002, the U.S. intelligence community prepared a comprehensive summary, called a National Intelligence Estimate, or NIE, of what it knew about Iraq's continuing programs for weapons of mass destruction, the title of the 92-page classified version of the report. It was prepared at the request of members of Congress, who expected to vote on going to war with Iraq and wanted something on which to base their vote. Written by one group of senior intelligence officers and then approved by the leaders of the U.S. intelligence community, the estimate pulled together in one place the core data of the Bush administration's argument for going to war. It reported that Iraq possessed chemical and biological weapons, was making advances in developing ways to weaponize and deliver biological weapons, and was reconstituting its nuclear program. The report appeared more certain on all fronts than previous intelligence assessments, but the finding on the nuclear program was especially surprising, because it was a shift from a series of previous conclusions by the intelligence community. In fact, the estimate amounted to a serious misrepresentation of views in the intelligence community, maximizing alarming findings while minimizing internal doubts about them. It effectively presented opinion as fact. The effect of this NIE can't be underestimated, said one general who talked frequently to Rumsfeld during this time. During the summer of 2002, he said, both Bush and Rumsfeld had been on the fence. Cheney, Wolfowitz, and Armitage were the hawks, he remembered. Each argued that we had to get rid of this guy, that time isn't on our side, and that there will be no better time to get rid of him. On the other side of the argument were Colin Powell and some lesser figures in the administration. They thought it was time to leverage the international community, especially since we'd scared the hell out of everybody. But then came the NIE, which had been pushed out unusually quickly in just a few weeks. Bush's view became that CIA Director George Tenet says they have WMD, and Cheney says don't get caught napping again like we did on 9/11, this general recalled. The president became convinced by that document and by Tenet's interpretation of it that going to war was the right thing to do. Over a year later, when the Senate Intelligence Committee reviewed the NIE in light of evidence that became available after the war, it came to the conclusion that the collective wisdom of the U.S. intelligence community, as represented in the estimate, had been stunningly wrong. Most of the major key judgments in the NIE either overstated or were not supported by the underlying intelligence reporting it would find. A series of failures, particularly in analytic tradecraft, led to the mischaracterization of the intelligence. Moreover, the errors and exaggerations weren't random, but all pushed in the same direction, toward making the argument that Iraq presented a growing threat. As a political document that made the case for war, the NIE of October 2002 succeeded brilliantly. As a professional intelligence product, it was shameful. But it did its job, which wasn't really to assess Iraqi weapons programs, but to sell a war. There was only one way to disprove its assertions: invade Iraq, which is what the Bush administration wanted to do. Responsibility for this low point in the history of U.S. intelligence must rest on the shoulders of George Tenet. Richard Perle's influence in the events leading up to war likely has been overstated. At the time the chairman of the Defense Policy Board, an advisory group, he also seems to have wielded some influence with the office of Vice President Cheney. Perle's main role, at least in public, seems to have been the one willing to be quoted in the media, saying in public what his more discreet allies in the Bush administration, such as I. Lewis Scooter Libby, Cheney's chief of staff, would say to reporters only on background. Perle resembles Wolfowitz in his approach, bright, incisive, and somewhat academic in tone, with an air of deliberation and precision. Yet while Wolfowitz seeks to persuade, Perle attacks, often seeming eager to pounce on his opponent's capabilities and to cast doubt on their integrity or intelligence. He also has a habit of making doubtful assertions as though they were generally accepted facts, such as his belief, now known to be wildly off base, that Saddam Hussein was far stronger at the end of Clinton's tenure than at the beginning. Perle would later explain how, at the Pentagon, analysts working for Feith, his old subordinate who had become Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, produced their alarming interpretation of the murky intelligence about Saddam Hussein, WMD, and terrorism. Within a very short period of time, they began to find links that nobody else had previously understood or recorded in a useful way, he said of those analysts. They noticed things that nobody else had noticed. It was there all along, it simply hadn't been noticed. This key information had been overlooked because the CIA and DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, were not looking. The way he described it, all that was needed was the fresh, unbiased eye of competent analysts, which in his view was provided by Feith's office at the Pentagon. The whinging, the complaints from the intelligence establishment who had overlooked this material are really quite pathetic. Perle's argument, ultimately, was that he and his allies simply were better at parsing the data than were their opponents in the intelligence community. Let me be blunt about this. The level of competence on past performance of the Central Intelligence Agency in this area is appalling. It was at this point that the Bush administration's views diverged from that of the intelligence community. There wasn't anyone in the intelligence community who was saying what the Pentagon analysts around Feith were saying, a senior military intelligence official recalled. There were a few stray analysts who connected some of those dots, but no one in the mainstream. The NIE, and especially its doubt-free summary version, offered only a dim and distorted reflection of their views. This particular official is more sympathetic than most of his peers to the Bush administration, but still emphatically rejects the administration's ex post facto defense that everybody got it wrong. The core conclusion of the best intelligence analyst was, he said, that we were looking for evidence, but we weren't finding it. But the failure to stop 9/11 had tarnished the credibility of the intelligence professionals and lessened the deference that others might give them. On top of that, relative amateurs working for Feith and Cheney felt free to seize on existing bits of data and push them as hard as they could, this official added. They would take individual factoids, build them into long lists, and then think because of the length of the list, it was credible. When the lists were rejected by intelligence professionals, they would be leaked to friendly journalists. Feith and his subordinates, especially Bill Luty, a former Navy officer who became a factotum for Administration Hawks, were essentially an extra-governmental organization because many of their sources of information and much of their work were in the shadows, said Gregory Newbold, the Marine general who was then the Joint Staff's operations director. It was also my sense that they cherry-picked obscure, unconfirmed information to reinforce their own philosophies and ideologies. Chapter 5. The Run-Up. By the time the public really focused on it, the decision to go to war had been made, though more through drift than through any one meeting. In September 2002, word began to circulate inside the military that an invasion of Iraq was inevitable and the march to war began. On September 9th, General Franks briefed the Joint Chiefs of Staff on the state of the war plan. The military was beginning to move, laying the groundwork by expanding the ramp space at airports in the Persian Gulf and upgrading key gear, such as special operations helicopters. 2 days later, on the first anniversary of 9/11, more than three dozen senators were invited to the Pentagon for a briefing by Rumsfeld on weapons of mass destruction. One of those attending, Senator Max Cleland of Georgia, was surprised to find Vice President Cheney and CIA Director Tenet also waiting there. It was pretty clear that Rumsfeld and Cheney are ready to go to war, Cleland wrote later that day in a note to himself. They have already made the decision to go to war, and to them that is the only option. Cleland had lost three limbs as a 1st Cavalry Division soldier in Vietnam in 1968, and was worried about Iraq becoming a similar mess. His note concluded, "Our country is divided at this point, and God knows what will happen." The next day, President Bush addressed the UN General Assembly for 26 minutes, most of them devoted to a description of Iraq as a grave and gathering danger. He explained his feeling of urgency. With every step the Iraqi regime takes toward gaining and deploying the most terrible weapons, our own options to confront that regime will narrow. And if anyone didn't get the point, the administration also issued a document titled, "The National Security Strategy of the United States of America," that formalized the preemption doctrine which the president had outlined in a speech at West Point in June. "We cannot let our enemies strike first," it stated. "The overlap between states that sponsor terror and those that pursue WMD compels us to action. To forestall or prevent such hostile acts by our adversaries, the United States will, if necessary, act preemptively." Congress wasn't looking for a fight with the president. The National Intelligence Estimate, in its full 92-page classified form, contained a host of doubts, caveats, and disagreements with Bush's assertions. Copies of that long form of the NIE were sent to Capitol Hill, where they sat in two vaults under armed guard. Yet only a handful of members of Congress ever read more than its 5-page executive summary. Delving into the dissent in the intelligence community would only have gotten a politician on the wrong side of the issue with the president. Many months later, after the U.S. military invaded Iraq, White House officials would disclose that neither Bush nor Rice had read the entire NIE. The congressional vote itself, authorizing President Bush to attack Iraq, was anticlimactic. When the House debate began, there was just one reporter in the press gallery. The exchanges on the Senate floor offered little of the memorable commentary seen in the two other most recent congressional debates on whether to go to war, in 1991 and in 1964, regarding the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. The outcome, lopsided support for Bush's resolution, was preordained, wrote the Washington Post's Dana Milbank. Republicans were going to support the president and their party, and Democrats wanted to move on to other issues that would help them more in the midterm elections that at that point were just 3 weeks away. Ultimately, 77 of 100 senators and 296 of 435 House members voted to authorize the president to use the armed forces of the United States as he determines to be necessary and appropriate in order to defend the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq. The majority of House Democrats voted against the war, but in the Senate, 29 Democrats backed the Bush administration's stance, while 21 voted against it. Rather than refute skeptics, the Pentagon's leaders followed Cheney's example and simply decided that the time for debate was past. Such an assertion might not affect civilians outside the government, but inside the military establishment it could be issued with the force of an order. The Joint Staff effectively stated that view in the form of a strategic guidance for combatant commanders. In mid-October, a draft of this guidance was sent out to planning officers on the staffs of the senior U.S. military commanders around the world, often called the SINCs. The message was simple. We are preparing to order that a war with Iraq be considered part of the war on terror. That was an unusual order, and smacked of a politicized military leadership. It provoked a series of swift responses, some of them quite blunt. How the hell did a war on Iraq become part of the war on terrorism? Was how one officer on the Joint Staff summarized the reaction of four of those commanders' staffers. The draft didn't seem consistent with a Pentagon directive exactly a year earlier that had laid out five clear lines of attack in a global counteroffensive against terrorism, all focused on hitting terrorist groups with global reach and their state sponsors. There is no link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, one of the responses argued. Don't mix the two. This is going to work hell with the Allies. What is going on? One of the officers who was caught in the middle of this went to Army Lieutenant General George Casey, then the J-5, the Chief of Strategic Plans and Policy on the staff of the Joint Chiefs, and reported these puzzled, angry comments from the field. Casey, who in 2004 was to become the top U.S. officer in Iraq, laid down the law. The discussion was over. Look, this is part of the war on terror. This officer remembered Casey instructing him. Iraq is one of those state supporters, and it is a state that has used weapons of mass destruction. That was the message that went out to the SINCs staffs near the end of 2002, in the form of a highly classified five-paragraph order. In a bureaucratic maneuver, in order to keep Feith from trying to edit it word by word and comma by comma, an excruciating process that the Joint Staff had come to dread, it was sent out as a change to an existing strategic guidance rather than as a new statement. Its third paragraph said that should it become necessary to conduct combat operations against Iraq, this activity was to be thought of as part of the wider war against terrorism. As that message was being finalized, Lieutenant General Newbold quietly retired from his job on the Joint Staff and left the military. It had been common knowledge on the staff that he opposed the invasion of Iraq, but he managed to keep that from leaking out. His is the only known departure from the senior ranks of the military over the looming Iraq war. Publicly, Newbold was discreet, saying he was leaving because he felt he owed it to his family and to younger officers so they could move up. At any rate, he said, the job of operations director is a square hole, and I am a round peg. In the intelligence community, analysts and their bosses began to shut up in the fall of 2002. No one had to tell them to do so. The feeling was, our job is to do what we're told, and this thing is going to happen, said the senior military intelligence official. The feeling was, it wasn't our place to raise a ruckus. Indeed, by this point the war already was beginning in quiet ways. Officers in the Gulf were told to be ready for war in spring. Army Lieutenant General David McKiernan, the commander of the ground invasion force, said in an official Army debriefing interview in the summer of 2003 that I think from last fall we knew it was a question of just when, not if. Likewise, in September, a senior U.S. intelligence official in Bahrain told colleagues, "You'll see all this diplomatic stuff, but it's clear we're going to war." In the summer and fall of 2002, a series of warnings were issued inside the military establishment about the right and wrong ways to approach Iraq. Most of these appear to have been ignored, mainly because the Bush administration tended not to listen to people outside a small circle of insiders. On August 26, the same day that Cheney effectively launched the march to war with his No Doubt speech to the VFW, a group of Army commanders and other top service officials met at the Army War College's bucolic campus on the outskirts of Carlisle, Pennsylvania, to review, among other things, the Central Command's middling performance in the Afghan campaign. The meeting concluded that major errors had been committed in the conduct of that offensive, especially in the handling of the larger strategic issues. This conclusion was meant to be descriptive of what had happened in the previous year, but it would also prove accurate in predicting what would go wrong in the handling of the Iraq War. The first major criticism on which the participants agreed was that the Afghan situation had been marred by the excessively short-term approach of top defense leaders. This problem of a tactical focus that ignores long-term objectives was especially notable at Central Command, said an internal Army memo that summarized the meeting's conclusions and that has never been released. As Sean Naylor of the Army Times later pointed out, Franks failed to grasp in waging the Afghan war that taking the enemy's capital wasn't the same as winning the war, a conceptual error he would repeat in Iraq. But the problem extended beyond that, and thus those meeting at the Army War College laid it at the feet of Rumsfeld and the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Air Force General Richard Myers, who took over just before the Afghan war began. All participants at the conference from all commands complained about the problems caused by a lack of clear higher direction, the summary emphasized. A more specific grievance was the insistence of the Pentagon on not using established deployment plans for units, and instead sending them out piecemeal. Headquarters have had to utilize scores of individual requests for forces to build organization in key theaters instead of formal tit-fiddle, another Army report on the meeting stated. Back then, this complaint about messing with the painstakingly developed TPFDL, an awkward acronym that military types pronounce tip-fiddle, and which stands for Time-Phased Force Deployment List, seemed minor, even obscure, but it would grow into an angry chorus in the Army during the invasion and occupation of Iraq, as it caused endless turmoil and confusion. The pernicious effect of these grab-bag augmentations is to create headquarters staffs with little experience or cohesion, the second report stated. One conference participant described the situation as playing the Super Bowl with a pickup team. Most ominously, the report warned that by overburdening undertrained staffs, the resulting turmoil especially undercut the military's ability to develop effective long-range plans. In November, Major General James Mattis, the commander of the 1st Marine Division, which would spend much of the next 2 years in Iraq, invited General Zinni to be the speaker at the division's Marine Corps birthday dinner, the most important day of the year for the Corps. On the afternoon before the dinner, Mattis had Zinni speak to all his senior commanders. "If you guys don't go through the enemy in 6 weeks, we'll disown you," Zinni said, according to Mattis. "But then the hard work begins. We have lit a fuse and we don't know what's at the other end. A nuke, a hand grenade, or a dud." Zinni's message to the assembled Marine commanders that afternoon was, "You are about to get into something that is going to be tougher and more chaotic than you might think. I was worried that we didn't understand the importance of maintaining order, that we had to come in with sufficient forces to freeze the situation, to understand that when we're ripping the guts out of an authoritarian regime, you've got responsibility for security, services, everything else. You have to be prepared to handle all that." He also warned the Marines that in such situations, the U.S. government tends to look to the military for solutions. The other caution I gave them was, don't count on it when somebody tells you, well, the State Department's got that, or OSD's planning for that. Don't believe them. You're going to get stuck with it, so have a plan. This is the desert crossing philosophy. You're going to end up being the stuckey on this. On December 10th and 11th, the Army staff at the Pentagon convened about 24 military experts, Middle East area specialists, diplomats, and intelligence officials at the Army War College to look at the missions that the service likely would face in post-war Iraq. Read now, with the benefit of hindsight, the report the group produced clearly is stunning in its prescience. The possibility of the United States winning the war and losing the peace is real and serious, they wrote in a lapel-gripping tone that was an unusual departure for government experts giving their bosses unwelcome advice. Thinking about the war now and the occupation later is not an acceptable solution. That was what the Army War College group had seen happen with Afghanistan, and some members of that group were hearing from friends at Central Command that the same screw-up was happening again. They also delivered a clear warning about the fragile state of the Iraqi economy, something that Bush administration officials would insist after the invasion had been a rude surprise. Iraq had been strained by decades of misrule, wars, and sanctions, they observed. If the United States assumes control of Iraq, it will therefore assume control of a badly battered economy. The writers repeatedly emphasized that Iraq was going to be tougher than the administration thought, or at least was admitting publicly. Successful occupation will not occur unless the special circumstances of this unusual country are heeded, they warned. They specifically advised against the two major steps that Ambassador L. Paul Bremer III would pursue in 2003 after being named to run the U.S. occupation. The Iraqi army should be kept intact because it could serve as a unifying force in a country that could fall apart under U.S. control. In a highly diverse and fragmented society like Iraq, the military is one of the few national institutions that stresses national unity as an important principle. To tear apart the army in the war's aftermath could lead to the destruction of one of the only forces for unity within the society. They likewise were explicit in warning against the sort of top-down de-bathification that Bremer would mandate. Rather, they recommended following the example of the U.S. authorities in post-World War II Germany, who used a bottom-up approach by having anti-Nazi Germans in every town review detailed questionnaires filled out by every adult German, and then determining one by one who would have their political and economic activities curtailed. The report received an enthusiastic response from the Army, said Conrad Crane, the Army historian running the group. He believes it also influenced the thinking of some Army generals preparing for the invasion of Iraq. But all that was preaching to the converted. The group heard very little from the Office of the Secretary of Defense or from Central Command. It was not clear to us until much later how unsuccessful General Shinseki and his staff had been in shaping the final plans, Crane said later. Then, in mid-2003, after the occupation had gotten off to a fumbled start, and Franks had left Central Command and retired from the Army, Crane was told that Abizaid, the new commander, was handing the report to everyone he met and telling them to read it. It was small consolation. What is remarkable is that again and again during the crucial months before the invasion, such warnings from experts weren't heeded or even welcomed. Almost no Middle Eastern experts inside the military were consulted on the war plan, in part because the plan was produced on a very close-hold basis that involved few people, and even then, only parts of it were shown to most of those involved. In 1991, General Schwarzkopf had made himself both the overall commander and the commander of land forces for the attack into Kuwait. Some in the Army thought that he had been overwhelmed by both tasks. One reason that the Army wasn't able to adjust its operations when the Marines moved into Kuwait faster than expected, and couldn't close the door on the Iraqi Army before it escaped northward. Franks took a different course, creating the Coalition Forces Land Component Command. That was the awkward name for the ground forces, The Army, the Marine Corps, and the British Army, along with a handful of Poles and other troops, who would ultimately invade Iraq. The CFLCC, which the military took to pronouncing Siflik, was another element of the war plan that amounted to a repudiation of Schwarzkopf's handling of the 1991 war. This time, they were going to go to Baghdad and do it right. Not all was well at Siflik. Its senior officers had worked for months to get Franks to stand up to Rumsfeld in the Pentagon. Major General James Thurman was Siflik's director for operations, arguably the second most important post in the organization. Neither he nor his commander, Army Lieutenant General David McKiernan, was happy with the war plans Franks was bringing back from his meetings with Rumsfeld. The initial plan put on the table had, in their view, been ridiculous. It called for a tiny force, consisting of one enhanced brigade from the 3rd Infantry Division and a Marine Expeditionary Unit, all in all fewer than 10,000 combat troops. It was little more than an update of the notions that had been kicked around during the 90s by Iraqi exiles, and that Zinni had nixed as a potential Bay of Goats. Over the course of 2002, the planned size of the force got larger, but hadn't quite reached what McKiernan saw as the minimum. Rumsfeld had come out of the Afghan War believing that speed could be substituted for mass in military operations. Franks had bought into this, summarizing it in the oft-repeated maxim, "Speed kills." McKiernan and Thurman weren't at all sure of that, and disliked the prospect of being Rumsfeld's guinea pigs. McKiernan had another smaller but nagging issue. He couldn't get Franks to issue clear orders that stated explicitly what he wanted done, how he wanted to do it, and why. Rather, Franks passed along PowerPoint briefing slides that he had shown to Rumsfeld. It's quite frustrating the way this works, but the way we do things nowadays is combatant commanders brief their products in PowerPoint up in Washington to OSD and Secretary of Defense. In lieu of an order or fragmentary order or plan, you get a set of PowerPoint slides. That is frustrating because nobody wants to plan against PowerPoint slides. That reliance on slides rather than formal written orders seemed to some military professionals to capture the essence of Rumsfeld's amateurish approach to war planning. Here may be the clearest manifestation of OSD's contempt for the accumulated wisdom of the military profession and of the assumption among forward thinkers that technology, above all, information technology, has rendered obsolete the conventions traditionally governing the preparation and conduct of war, commented retired Army Colonel Andrew Basevich, a former commander of an armored cavalry regiment. To imagine that PowerPoint slides can substitute for such means is really the height of recklessness. It was like telling an automobile mechanic to use a manufacturer's glossy sales brochure to figure out how to repair an engine. At the Pentagon, the policy shop run by Douglas Feith was the organization that was in many ways the civilian parallel of Frank's Central Command in formulating the American stance on going to war in Iraq. CENTCOM was responsible for handling the war, while Feith's office was supposed to oversee the policies guiding the war and its aftermath. Both Frank's headquarters and Feith's policy office had notably low morale. But a major difference was that Feith's office was managed worse. While Franks was at least effective in getting what he wanted from underlings, the owlish Feith was a management disaster who served as a bottleneck on decision-making. He basically was a glorified gopher for Rumsfeld, said Gary Schmidt, who was hardly an ideological foe. He was the executive director of the Project for a New American Century, a small neoconservative advocacy group that pushed hard for the invasion of Iraq. He can't manage anything, and he doesn't trust anyone else's judgment. People working for Feith complained that he would spend hours tweaking their memos, carefully mulling minor points of grammar. A joint staff officer recalled angrily that at one point troops sat on a runway for hours waiting to leave the United States on a mission while he quibbled about commas in the deployment order. Policy was a black hole, recalled one four-star general about Feith's operation. It dropped the ball again and again. In the summer of 2001, Feith had been confronted on his management flaws by top aides at a large meeting. Lisa Bronson, a veteran specialist on weapons proliferation, stood and said, "This is the worst-run policy office I've ever seen." Another Feith aide agreed, saying later that the decision-making process in Feith's office was the most tangled he'd seen in 20 years of government work. Feith stood his ground, explaining to subordinates that, "I don't treat you any differently than Rumsfeld treats me." He said his fussiness over memos reflected the importance he and Rumsfeld placed on precision in thinking and writing. Feith amounted to a less impressive version of Wolfowitz, filling the post the older man had held during the 1991 Gulf War. A 1975 graduate of Harvard, he was similar to Wolfowitz in his academic approach, to the military way of thinking, which tends to like orderly discussions that march toward clear decisions. He appeared far too woolly. For Feith, as for Wolfowitz, the Holocaust and the mistakes the West made appeasing Hitler in the 1930s rather than stopping him became a keystone in thinking about policy. Like Wolfowitz, Feith came from a family devastated by the Holocaust. His father lost both parents, 3 brothers, and 4 sisters to the Nazis. "My family got wiped out by Hitler. And all this stuff about working things out, well, talking to Hitler to resolve the problem didn't make any sense to me," Feith later told Jeffrey Goldberg of The New Yorker in discussing how World War II had shaped his views. "The kind of people who put bumper stickers on their car that declare that war is not the answer, are they making a serious comment? What's the answer to Pearl Harbor? What's the answer to the Holocaust?" Senior military officers especially seemed to be rubbed the wrong way by Feith. Franks, the Central Command chief, called him the dumbest fucking guy on the planet. Jay Garner, the retired Army lieutenant general who reported to Feith for 5 months as the Bush administration's first head of the post-war mission in Iraq, came to a similar conclusion. "I think he's incredibly dangerous," Garner said later. "He's a very smart guy whose electrons aren't connected, so he arc lights all the time. He can't organize anything." Remarkably, Feith was the person in charge of day-to-day post-war Iraq policy in Washington, the official that Franks was told would handle the post-war end of things, a man who couldn't run his own office very well by many accounts, was going to oversee the rebuilding of an occupied nation on the other side of the planet. The U.S. invasion of Iraq, Army Lieutenant Colonel James Scudieri wrote later, may be the most planned operation since D-Day on 6 June 1944 and Desert Storm in 1991. The irony is that in 18 months of planning, the key question was left substantially unaddressed. What to do after getting to Baghdad? Franks, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Feith, and other top officials spent well over a year preparing to attack Iraq, but treated almost casually what would come after that. "I think people are overly pessimistic about the aftermath," Wolfowitz flatly stated in an interview in December 2002. At first, in the summer of 2002, the ball was tossed to the exhausted planning staff at Central Command, which had just finished invading Afghanistan and then written 2 versions of a plan to invade Iraq. "End of July, we just finished the second plan, and we get an order from Joint Staff saying, 'You're in charge of the post-war plan,'" recalled Colonel John Agoglia. They were flabbergasted. At that point, they thought the invasion would be launched in just 6 months. "We said, 'Oh, shit,' did a mission analysis, and focused on humanitarian issues, such as minimizing the displacement of people, stockpiling food to stave off famine, and protecting the infrastructure of the oil fields," he said. The decision to place the Defense Department, whether at the Pentagon or at the Central Command headquarters, in charge of post-war Iraq may have doomed the American effort from the start. As a subsequent Rand Corporation study put it, overall, this approach worked poorly because the Defense Department lacked the experience, expertise, funding authority, local knowledge, and established contacts with other potential organizations needed to establish, staff, support, and oversee a large multi-agency civilian mission. It wasn't that there was no planning. To the contrary, there was a lot, with at least three groups inside the military and one at the State Department working on post-war issues and producing thousands of pages of documents. But much of the planning was shoddy. There was no one really in charge of it, and there was little coordination between the various groups. General Franks appeared to believe that planning for the end of the war was someone else's job. The message he sent to Rumsfeld's subordinates, he wrote in his autobiography, was, "You pay attention to the day after, and I'll pay attention to the day of." The result would be that while there was much discussion and endless PowerPoint briefings, there wouldn't be a real plan for post-war Iraq that could be implemented by commanders and soldiers on the ground. To handle the stepped-up load of planning for post-war Iraq, Franks created a new office, Joint Task Force 4, under Brigadier General Steve Hawkins, an Army engineer. For months, Hawkins had scores of staff planners working on Phase 4. That is, the phase that followed Phase 3's major combat operations, but failed to produce much. "We were told that JTF 4 would be a standing task force," recalled Agoglia. "We thought that it would be the core of planning for a post-conflict headquarters. Instead, it was Steve Hawkins and 55 yahoos with shareware who were clueless." Despite months of work, they didn't produce a plan, Army Lieutenant General Joseph Kellogg said. They may have war-gamed it, but planned it? Nope. That may seem a harsh verdict, but it is borne out by a look at the classified PowerPoint briefings JTF-4 produced. It is fashionable to criticize the U.S. military's heavy reliance on PowerPoint, but the 32 slides in the JTF-4 summary of planning for post-war Iraq are extreme in their incoherence, with unexplained distinctions between military success in Phase 3 and strategic success under civilian lead in Phase 4. Interestingly, another briefing on reconstruction issues noted in an aside that the Army experience in Bosnia and Kosovo indicated that the post-war situation in Iraq would require around 470,000 troops, more than triple the number that actually would be deployed. But no one appears to have informed other military planners about the flimsiness of CENTCOM's Phase 4 work. A classified pre-war briefing by the next lower headquarters, the Coalition Forces Land Component Command, CIFLC, on its own Phase 4 plans, breezily noted that it was working with CJTF-4 to ensure seamless transition. Chapter 6, The Silence of the Lambs, January through March, 2003. In previous wars, Congress had been populated by hawks and doves. But as war in Iraq loomed, it seemed to consist mainly of lambs who hardly made a peep. There were many failures in the American system that led to the war, but the failures in Congress were at once perhaps the most important and the least noticed. The last chance for voicing reservations was offered by hearings on Iraq held in February 2003, but this was not an opportunity that Congress would take. It had made its choice the previous October when it gave the president a blank check to go to war. As a body, it was willing to ask questions, but that was little more than a pose, because it didn't object when it didn't get responses that spoke to the issue. It was a Congress that would take no, or something close to it, for an answer. Douglas Feith's appearance before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at its major pre-war hearing on Iraq was a memorable demonstration of testimony as tap dancing. He couldn't say how many troops might be required, or what a war might cost, or even what other countries might join the U.S.-led effort. "Senator, it's hard to answer a lot of these what-ifs because a lot depends on, you know, future events that we don't know," Feith told Senator Joseph Biden, the Delaware Democrat who was the ranking minority member on the panel. "There are enormous uncertainties. As for the key question of the duration of the occupation," Feith deferred answering. "I don't think I want to venture into the prediction business," he parried. The senators knew they weren't getting straight answers. There's a kind of disconnect between the rhetoric we're hearing and all the rosy scenarios, noted Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island. "Why aren't we hearing some more about a worst case? And what are we prepared for in that instance?" Senator Russell Feingold also expressed puzzlement. "Why do we give the president a blank check to go ahead with this before we had the answers to these questions?" he asked. The American people have no notion of what we are about to undertake, Biden concluded that day. It was an important observation about a democracy about to launch a war in a distant land, alien culture, and hostile region, but it was made in a tone of passive resignation. The first casualty of the Iraq War may have been the reputation of Secretary of State Colin Powell. In February 2003, Powell went to the United Nations and staked his personal credibility on going to war. It was the old general's ultimate sacrifice as a good soldier, throwing his reputation behind the administration's campaign and using it to clear out some of the remaining opposition to going to war. My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources, Powell said early in the speech, as the CIA's tenant sat behind him, as if literally backing him up. These are not assertions. What we are giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence. Indeed, Powell appeared to lift the veil on highly classified intelligence sources and methods, sharing crown jewel information such as intercepted Iraqi military communications. We have first-hand descriptions of biological weapons factories on wheels and on rails. Our conservative estimate is that Iraq today has a stockpile of between 100 and 500 tons of chemical weapons agent. He remains determined to acquire nuclear weapons. What I want to bring to your attention today is the potentially much more sinister nexus between Iraq and the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. Powell didn't know it, but his bravura performance was a huge